You've tuned to The Turley Frequency, starring your host, Kevin Turley, with guest stars Mike Romano and Reed Hodges, and special guest stars, the members of the FCC, whom we respect respectfully. Now, time to get tuned into The Frequency. Call the show at 888-928-0881. That's 888-928-0881. Or text us at 251-928-2111. And now we cross live to the Archangel Radio Studios in downtown Fairhope to at last feel the Turley Frequency.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to today's Wednesday's edition of the Turley Frequency. And on it, we meet the best-selling author and historian, H.W. Crocker III. I'm going to have to do something about that name. Who has written fiction and non-fiction in equal measure and with equal success. We talk with Mr. Crocker in the next segment. Top of the hour, we pray the Divine Mercy Chaplet. And guess what? You're invited to join us. That's right. Feel free to text me your prayer requests on 251-928-2111. Finally today, we meet one of Archangel Radio's newest board members, Mr. Jim Pochinski. He's coming up in the final segment. Okay, with all this good stuff, I guess we'd better get this show on the road. Hello and welcome to Wednesday's edition. And the sun is shining here in London. I know, I feel like running outside and taking a photograph. It's amazing. We have a sunny day. This must be our summer here in London. I'm sorry to go on about the weather, but we just had such depressing weather for weeks and weeks and weeks. Rain, rain, rain. Grey skies and rain. I was getting texts from family members and friends saying, is this really August? I would text back and say, no, it's October. Didn't you get the memo? So good to have your company this morning. I enjoy being here, even if you don't. I really do. I love coming in here and talking to you each day on this Wednesday morning, whether you're at home, whether you're at work, in hospital, especially if you're in hospital, whether you're in a bar serving or drinking, or whether you're behind bars serving, just serving. You are all very welcome to this show. Now, as always, we have a new custom on this show, which is we check all our instrumentation. We check all our systems. Reed is, if nothing, an ultimate professional. So, Reed, let's hear it. Are we ready to roll?
Give me a go, no go for launch. Booster.
Go.
Retro.
Go.
Vital.
We're go flight.
Guidance.
Guidance go.
Surgeon.
Go flight.
Ecom.
We're go flight.
GNC.
We're go.
Telemu.
Go.
Control.
Go flight.
Procedures.
Go.
Inco.
Go.
FAO.
We are go.
Network.
Go.
Recovery.
Go.
Capcom.
We're go flight.
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
I'll take that as a maybe. Maybe we're ready to go. No, that sounds like we are up and ready, ready to go. Now, listen, have you heard the latest information about depression? Seems pretty apt if you're listening to this show, you know. Yeah, there's been a new survey all about depression. So let me ask you, if I could be just personal for a moment, and don't worry, there's just you and me here. Are you feeling low, feeling depressed, maybe a touch of the blues? Well, a new piece of research coming out of the UK, where else, may have the answer. And I can sum it up in two words. Well, one word, actually. Nuts. That's right. A recent study suggests that eating nuts could have surprising mental health benefits. You heard this? The study was published in a journal, The Clinical Nutrition. I'm sure, like me, you read nothing else. And it was found that eating about 30 grams of nuts every day can help lower the risk of depression in adults.
Kevin, are you sure that it didn't actually say that being nuts would
help your mental health?
That helps too, but that's a different show.
Okay, okay.
that's the show they get every day on this channel with me. Being nuts definitely makes you – I mean, if you are nuts, you don't even realize the world is going to hell in a handcart. But if you're like the rest of us, who occasionally may suffer from the doldrums – do you remember that? You used to talk about the doldrums. Maybe you don't talk about it in the States. Basically, when you're feeling a bit down in the dumps – I'm not talking about clinical depression. Obviously, go and see your doctor if you're feeling that bad. Go and see your priest if you're feeling really, really bad. Okay. But for the rest of us, especially Monday mornings, you know, a handful of nuts, 30 grams of nuts, may be the answer to perking us up. Yep, there was a survey done of 13,500 people in the UK. So it was a pretty big survey. And the ages ranged from 37 to 73. And I don't know how they do these tests, whether they force fed them nuts every single day. Perhaps they did. Or they sent them some nuts each day and they would eat them. But anyway, the study came up with a self-reported sort of diagnosis of eating nuts, alleviating various symptoms of depression. Now, it sounds a little bit too good to be true. All the nuts that were consumed were of a variety. There wasn't any one particular nut that seemed to crack it, if I can put it like that. Some nuts were almonds, some were cashews, some pistachios, some salted, some roasted, and some even the humble peanut. The journal reports that the author said this study analyzed the prospective association between nut consumption and the risk of depression in a large sample of middle-aged and older adults in the UK. Makes you wonder about adults in the UK, I would say. I mean, what do they get up to? I mean, if 30 grams of nuts, which is quite a small number of nuts, they actually measured out how many nuts that would be per type of nuts. So that would be 20 almond nuts, 10 Brazil nuts, 15 cashew nuts, 40 peanuts, and 30 pistachio kernels. Now, I don't know about you, but I would never sit there and count out 15 cashew nuts. I'd just take a handful and probably another handful and another handful, because that's the thing about nuts. I don't know about you. I find that once I start eating nuts, you know, you just keep eating them, right? And then you feel a bit ill. You feel a bit depressed if you eat too many nuts. So the secret is to have a few nuts. Now, I'm talking of people in need. I wonder, Reid, if we have any messages left overnight on our hotline, our new listener hotline, our new service to the listener out there to be able to communicate directly at any time, 24/7, with this show. So we do that by leaving messages. We had a beautiful message last week left for us from a ship traveling through the Pacific Ocean. A young mariner, a French mariner who listens to the show, left us a beautiful message. So maybe today on this Wednesday, we will also have some beautiful messages of encouragement that will help us through this week. So Reid, let's have, well, first of all, do we have any messages?
Yes, Kevin, we have a couple here.
Okay, well, let's play them.
They are not message from overseas. The first one that we received, the very beautiful message from Louise. Mm-hmm. These are domestic ones. I can tell by the numbers.
Okay, so somebody in the Mobile Fairhope area probably calling the show. Okay, well, let's go with message one.
Oh, help! Help! Help me!
Right, okay. Well, that's a start. Obviously, that was a cry for help. I think we can honestly identify that as. I'm wondering what the second message is, Reid.
I'll go ahead and play it for us, Kevin.
Thank you. Right. I think that's that mother asking for prayers again. Okay. Well, look, there's some of the comments from our community out there, or our audience participation on this show. And, well, you heard the bit about the nuts. Maybe a handful of nuts for each of those callers will do the trick. Now, as you know, as you know, we've got Harry Crocker coming up. I'm calling him Harry Crocker. His name is H.W. Crocker III. But as I say, I'm going to have to do something about that because it's too much of a mouthful. But it's good that we have such a best-selling author coming up today, because today is National Book Lovers Day. National Book Lovers Day, that's right. Now, I don't know about you, but when I first saw that, I thought, not another one of these national days, you know, these national days that keep coming up, and they get sillier and sillier. But actually, I think there's something in this National Book Lovers Day, because we live in an age where people are reading less. Books, that is. People are reading more online, they're reading snippets of things, they're watching things on YouTube or whatever. I mean, I forget the figure, I saw it a few years ago, it's probably much worse now, but each day, something like YouTube has approximately a billion hits every single day. People absorbing and consuming information from places like YouTube, which means they're not reading books. Now, even 20 or 30 years ago, the number of books being read was much greater than we can imagine today. How do I know that? Well, when I used to travel around on the underground, everybody was reading a book. That it'd be a newspaper or a book. That was the way of it. And London, you know, I remember somebody who came to London to work here from South Africa, and he was amazed at how much people were reading each day on the trains. He couldn't believe it. He said, this must be the best read city in the world. And I kind of know what he meant. I think it's time to rediscover the joys of reading. And I say that as a kind of recovered reader. During the pandemic, do you remember that? Happened a couple of years ago, something to do with something called COVID. We were all locked in. Do you remember? We were all locked in our homes, our houses for quite a considerable period of time. It was a very unusual event, like nothing I have ever experienced in my life. And to be honest, I'm not sure I ever want to experience it again. I told you I was speaking to two people who worked in the medical profession around that time, a doctor and a nurse that are married. And both of them one day just said that collectively they had completely forgotten everything that happened during the pandemic, deliberately, probably. They didn't want to be reminded of it. They were very happy to never, ever revisit the experiences they had during that time. Now, I remember when the pandemic started, I thought, well, this is great in one sense. I mean, it was horrible in all sorts of sense, but I thought at least then I will get the chance to read all these books that I've been putting aside for weeks, months, and years. And here's the funny thing. During the pandemic, I found that my consumption of reading of any sort decreased dramatically. That's right, it decreased. It didn't increase, it decreased. And I found myself becoming mentally lethargic. I got out of the habit of reading. And I think I have struggled. And now, this is somebody who read a book a week for years. Easily, a book a week at least a year. And I would have two or three books on the go, be reading the Bible, different things. This was just part and parcel of normal life as far as I was concerned. In fact, sometimes I thought I maybe read too much. But all of that just collapsed with the pandemic. I found myself just not wanting to read anything, struggling to get into books. Even books I had to read because I had to review them, or I had to read them for professional reasons of some sort, I really struggled until this year. And then I started, for whatever reason, I started getting back into it. And I think it's a gift being able to read, the more I think about it. The appreciation of reading. I think it's a gift. I really do. I'm going to give you a couple of quotes here. I love these quotes. From C.S. Lewis, you can never get a cup of tea large enough or a book long enough to suit me. There speaks a true Brit and tea drinker and book reader, bibliophile. But I love this one from Groucho Marx. Now, Groucho Marx, not to be confused with Karl Marx. Groucho Marx, the comedian's humor and philosophy, was much saner than Karl Marx, who started communism. Groucho had this to say: I find television very educating. Every time somebody turns on the set, I go into the other room and read a book. So this is what he's talking about, really. Now, if you think things were bad with television, and they were, people stopped reading books and started watching television back in the 50s and the 60s and so forth. Just think how bad things have gotten now with our smartphones and our tablets and our laptops. It's very hard. You have to make a conscious effort to read a book here on this day of National Book Lovers Day. But here's food for thought. Ray Bradbury, do you remember him? Great sci-fi writer of the 1960s. Great writer, more than just a sci-fi writer. He said this: you don't have to burn books to destroy a culture. Just get people to stop reading them. Just get people to stop reading them. He's right. He's absolutely right. People that don't read, you know them when you meet them. It's very clear. I mean, I've worked, as you know, for many years in journalism, and you can always tell the journalists who are readers and the journalists who read very little. You can tell straight away. And it's to do with the fact that they understand words and the communication of words. The people who write, who simply listen to stuff and observe stuff online and stuff, their writing is deficient in lots and lots of ways. You can tell. There is a rich culture of writing, literary culture, which was preeminent, really, until probably the mid-20th century. But you miss out on so much on by not reading. And take this from Descartes, another philosopher, French philosopher, from probably the 18th century. He wrote the following: the reading of all good books is like conversation with the finest people of the past centuries. With the finest people of the past. He's right. He's absolutely right. Saint Francois de Sales, who's the patron saint of writers and journalists, he said something very similar. He said that with books, you could have the best spiritual guides, i.e. the saints, because first of all, it was written down. Secondly, that it was, they were dead. You know, they were safe. What they were saying was eternal in terms of its wisdom. It wasn't predicated on the latest fads or such like. But just don't take saints' words for it or philosophers. Stephen King, who's written a few books himself, he said books are uniquely portable magic. And he's right. Just think for a moment what the printing press did for all of us. You can walk around with books. You can enter into another universe. You can engage with the minds from the Greeks, the Romans, or before, all because of a printed page. It's a miracle. It's a miracle. There's so many good quotes. I wrote down all these quotes here today, but I'm not going to go through them all. So what I'm going to say to you is that we Catholics have to think about our reading, because today is the feast day of Edith Stein. And Edith Stein, as you know, was a convert from Judaism to, well, she was born Jewish. She very quickly lost her faith in Judaism. She became an atheist and very much a philosopher, very secular. And then in 1921, she stayed in a friend's house. And being a woman of acute intelligence and sharp intellect, she picked up a book, which was the autobiography of St. Teresa of Avila, the 16th century Spanish mystic and saint, doctor of the church. And Edith read the whole thing from start to finish in one sitting overnight. She was that kind of woman. And the next day she came down to breakfast and said, "This is the truth. Reading, finding that book and reading it changed that woman's life forever." We can honestly say that, forever. Why? Because after that, she very quickly became Catholic. Shortly after that, she became a nun. And then she ended up losing her life at Auschwitz on account of her Jewish heritage. Today, she is a saint. And she's also a patron of Europe and a patron of young people. She's one of the patrons of World Youth Day. And that all happened because of what she read. So my question to you today, to all the book lovers out there, is this: what are you reading at this moment? Now, don't tell me the books you'd like to read, you know, The War and Peace, Great Expectations, Moby Dick. Yeah. What are you reading today? And if you're just reading what's online, ask yourself, could you be reading something else? Could you be reading something else? And of course, the greatest book of all is the Bible. And it's something that we Catholics, we Christians, should be reading every single day. And do so with a good commentary, because there's parts of the scriptures which are a bit obscure in places. Okay, when we come back, we're going to be continuing this bibliophile theme with our guest, Mr. Crocker, author of Too Many Books to Mention. Stay tuned to the Turley Frequency here live and exclusive on Archangel Radio. Frequency here live and exclusive on Archangel Radio. I'm your host, Kevin Turley, welcoming you this Wednesday morning. It's so good to have your company. Now, as we've been saying, today is National Book Lovers Day, and to honor that, we are joined by H.W. Crocker III, who is a best-selling author of the prize-winning comic novel The Old Limey, the Custer of the West series, and several historical works, including Triumph, The Power and Glory of the Catholic Church, A 2,000-Year History, The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Civil War, The Politically Incorrect Guide to the British Empire, The Yanks Are Coming, A Military History of the United States in World War I, Robert E. Lee on Leadership, and much else besides. We could be here all morning just reading out this bibliography. Mr. Crocker's journalism has also appeared in the National Review, the American Spectator, Crisis, the National Catholic Register, the Washington Times, and many other outlets. A native of San Diego, California, and educated there and here in England, he is married to a former cheerleader and lives in seclusion in the Deep South. Well, we've managed to bring him out of that seclusion, and H.W. Crocker III joins me down the line this morning. Mr. Crocker, welcome to the Turley Frequency.
Well, thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
Now, may I call you Harry? Otherwise, it's going to be a real mouthful.
You may call me Harry. That's perfectly fine, yes.
Now, Harry, on this day, which is National Book Lovers Day, I'm going to put you on the spot. Now, it's always a difficult question for an author. I know that. But what are the books, leaving aside the Bible, what are the books that you constantly return to that really sort of fire your imagination, or that you sit and think, I wish I'd written that?
Wow. Well, that's a good question. I like a lot of the Catholic authors of the sort of Evelyn Waugh and Graham Greene. But I'll also mm-hmm. toss out one that is, he was a Catholic convert, but he's long forgotten now, or much forgotten. His name was Siegfried Sassoon. His mm-hmm. chief fame was as a war poet in the First World War. But the book I really like of his is a prose work. It's called The Complete Memoirs of George Sherston, and it's a thinly veiled autobiography of his life as a fox hunting man in England and Ireland. That's the first volume. And then it becomes Memoirs of an Infantry Officer in the First World War and Sherston's Progress. And it seems to me it's a beautiful rendition of both rural English and Irish life, and also a great example of what it means to be a gentleman, because he's constantly wounded and he's sort of carelessly courageous, and he keeps going back to the front. And at one point in the book, this is all actually true. He decides, he's recovering from, I think, a head wound, but he thinks the war is pointless and he wants to make a protest against the war. And so he does, but the presiding doctors, the military doctors, decide that he was not in his right senses, that what he really needs is a golfing vacation in Scotland. And that's sort of, you know, old style, oh yes, a little golf will fix him up attitude. Well, strikes me as an admirable thing.
There's a touch of the Bertie Wooster's about that, I think, Harry, which reminds me of a story. This is totally, but there's a very holy Jesuit that used to, I met him at the end of his life. He's a very interesting man, but he used to teach boys at various times in his life. And they would ask him, you know, Father, how do you deal with depression, you know? Or no, he would ask them, what do you do when the world turns upside down, when you're feeling depressed, when everything's going against you, what do you do? And they would say the usual things, you know, Father, we go to a doctor. No, go and see a priest. No, what do you do, Father? And he said, read P.G. Woodhouse.
Yes.
which is along the same lines as you're saying, you know, something exactly. Which is taking you out of yourself. But anyway, enough of all of this, Harry, because you are a best-selling author, which is wonderful. Where to start? I mean, one of the things that most impresses me, Harry, is that you alternate between fiction and nonfiction in quite a considerable way. What gives you greater pleasure, or is it just different aspects of the same pleasure?
Well, that's a good question, too. I mean, I will say the history of the Catholic Church I wrote was probably definitely the most rewarding book. In fact, I don't mean to sound overly mystical or whatever about it, but I wrote that book at high speed, and I know it has had a bit of big effect in many people's lives to the degree where I don't really feel I can take full credit for it. Like, my hand was guided. I've actually talked to people. In fact, Protestant pastors who were converted, they came up to me and told me they were converted by reading Triumph, which was sort of, you know, a jaw-dropping experience. It made you think, well, I hope I'm right then, but I'm sure I am. And I know the Lee book, I mean, this Robert E. Lee book that they've just reissued in paperback has been around for almost 25 years now. And I know that it has been wildly popular with people in management roles. In fact, I remember I went to go speak at a conference in California, a Catholic conference, and I discovered there that the book they were most interested in having me autograph was not Triumph. It was this Robert E. Lee book, because it was being used to teach moral leadership at a Catholic hospital nearby. Wow. In fact, I'll tell you another story that's related to it. It's very similar. I was once called to see three nuns down by EWTN, and I assumed they wanted me to come see them because they wanted to talk about, again, Triumph, the history of the Catholic Church. And so I asked them that, and they said, no, we love that book, but what we want to talk to you really about is Robert E. Lee on leadership. And I said, really? Wow. I said, well, you realize he was a great Christian man, but he was not a Catholic. And they said, well, he is now.
As only nuns can. I mean, that's my first introduction to you, Harry, was with Triumph, the Power and the Glory of the Catholic Church. I had an American friend in London who had this large, thick volume of it sitting on a desk, and I thought, what's this? I mean, the name Triumph in those days around the Catholic Church was an interesting one. But it just so happened, total coincidence, that where my wife and I were living at the time was a rented property, and our landlord was living in America called Crocker. And I thought to myself, oh, I wonder if it's the same Crocker.
Only I wish. No.
Probably not. But let's talk a little bit about Robert E. Lee, because you're probably aware that he is somewhat controversial these days.
Yeah, no. I will say that I am 62 years old, and the two things in my life that have changed the most dramatically. One is this whole transgender thing. That was unthinkable maybe, 5 years ago or so. I mean, it's just an incredible, unbelievable inversion of reality. But the second thing is the way that people now regard the Civil War. If you look throughout the 20th century, if you look up to, I remember I was a speechwriter for the governor of California in the early 90s, and back then a very popular TV show on PBS was Ken Burns' Civil War.
Yes,
and,
yes, you know, absolutely.
It was a liberal take, but everyone, liberal, conservative, you know, Republican, Democrat, whatever, they all treated the South and the Confederacy with respect. The idea was that it was like America's Iliad, that there were noble and good people on both sides. You know, the Greeks versus the Trojans, and you had noble Christian Lee, you know, the Marble Man. You had daring Christian leaders like Stonewall Jackson and the jaunty cavalier like Jeb Stuart, all on the Confederate side. And you had politicians going way back. I mean, people like like Teddy Roosevelt, who said that, you know, as Americans, we can take proud, we take pride in both the glory won by the boys in blue and the boys won by the boys in gray, because both fought for the right as they sought to see the right. You had Winston Churchill calling Lee one of the noblest Americans that ever lived and one of the greatest captains in military history. You had Viscount Garnet Wolseley, Field Marshal of the British Army, during the height of the British Empire under Queen Victoria, who said, I'm paraphrasing all these things, of course, but they're virtually word for word. He said, I've met many of the great men of my time, but none of them has struck me as cast with a finer metal, a higher metal, a greater metal than this man, Robert E. Lee. So this guy, Lee only lived for 5 years after the war. But in that short period of time, not only did he go beyond his military heroism and his role as a sort of a tragic Christian, a stoic Christian hero, but he became a unifying figure. A newspaper in New York, I can't remember which one now offhand, but said the Democrats, if they have any chance of an election, need to nominate Robert E. Lee for president because he's the only one who can beat Ulysses S. Grant. Which shows that, you know, these characters were not just regional heroes. They were national heroes. And it seems to me that the reason they have been disparaged and taken down is twofold. And the main reason is because somehow, just as the sort of cultural Marxism has taken over every institution of our country, this is part of it. And it succeeded in part, I have to say, through the complicity of many of what we call, quote-unquote, our own people who didn't understand what was going on. But they applied this sort of critical race theory to our own history. And so to them, the easy targets were the Confederates, to start off with. Oh, slave owners, right? Fought for slavery, all that sort of thing. They all go down. Well, inevitably, of course, who else goes down? Everyone else. Because everyone from Abraham Lincoln to Theodore Roosevelt to the founders can all be taken down with a sort of Marxist critique in one form or another. And it's just, it is a revolutionary war in our history, which has obviously succeeded to a jaw-dropping degree. And if it does succeed, it will change the way Americans think about themselves, their identity, who they are, in a very bad way. Because when those statues went up, it wasn't just to mark like mystic cords of memory, to, you know, take a line from Lincoln's. Those have been snapped. It's also because these men represented something beyond battlefield heroism, that they were very heroic and courageous and clever men. But they were Christian. Many of them are overwhelmingly Christian men. And what made Lee stand apart was his faith and his belief in divine providence and this idea that, you know, all things, no matter what we're suffering now, will eventually come to some sort of good. And this is shown over and over in his life.
Could you pinpoint a moment, Harry? You've observed this. I mean, you wrote this book 25 years ago. You must have been a keen observer of the way that history is used and misused. Can you pinpoint a moment when suddenly it turned, when suddenly you thought, aha, this new reality is now emerging, which will upend everything we've ever thought before in terms of the Civil War, in terms of Robert E. Lee?
Well, I guess I like the old Hemingway line. It started gradually and then it happened suddenly. you could sort of see, I mean, when I was growing up, everyone would say, it was almost a matter of sophistication, but sophistication owned by most everyone, that, you know, of course the slavery was an issue in the Civil War, but it wasn't the only issue, and there's lots of other things involved, and blah, 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 blah.
Sure.
But that well-founded idea kept getting pushed farther and farther aside with this sort of cartoonish version that it was all about racism, and that the Confederacy, which was a very libertarian sort of organization. If you look at their constitution, the president couldn't run for more than one term. Of course, the states had great power, and the federal government didn't, and blah, blah, blah. But this idea that they were kind of proto-Nazis, I mean, they were about the farthest thing you could imagine from being proto-Nazis. But that idea started gaining hold, I can only assume because of, you know, senses of guilt about slavery and other racial issues. But it took a long time, because even as long, I mean, I remember when I, like in, they made the Dukes of Hazzard movie, I think in 2005 or something.
That's right.
And I remember when I worked for the governor, I used to park next to a car that was all decked out like the Robert E. Lee from the Dukes of Hazzard. And it wasn't, no one, or let me put it this way, a small minority of people thought that the waving the colored battle flag was like being a Klansman. For most people, it was a symbol of sort of Southern pride, you saw it in country music all the time, and so I'm a rebel sort of thing. We had this sort of well-founded, heroic view of American history. It was both a tragedy, but it was also something we could take pride in. And
Absolutely. That
has been replaced with just guilt. And of course, the Black Lives Matter thing was, you know, one of the things that really put it over the top. But there are other incidents before that.
Absolutely. You're listening to the voice of H.W. Crocker III, and when we come back, we will continue this fascinating discussion on history and all sorts of other things. You're listening to The Turley Frequency, here live and exclusive on Archangel Radio. Back to the Turley Frequency here, live and exclusive on Archangel Radio. I'm in a fascinating discussion with H.W. Crocker III, who is an award-winning and best-selling author of both fiction and non-fiction. And at the moment, we're discussing his book on Robert E. Lee, Robert E. Lee on Leadership. During the break, Harry, I was texted by a listener who said the following. The Smithsonian National Portrait Gallery just did an exhibition on the Civil War and did not mention one Confederate general.
I mean, that's the thing with so much of this stuff, is it's just asinine. I mean, again, to go back to the transgender thing, I mean, who believes a man is a woman is a man if they want to be? I mean, no one. I mean, we're being forced to tell lies. And I know that, and I think it was, wasn't it someplace in England where they are having an exhibit for Harry Potter, and they deleted J.K. Rowling's name. She can't be mentioned because she's athwart the transgender orthodoxy. And here too, the Civil War. I mean, we have to tell lies about what, you know, just a generation ago or so, we all knew to be true. And to tell harmful lies about our own country, that's the other thing I really can't understand, is how so many people are so eager to chuck an accurate view of the war that was a patriotically reaffirming view of the war in favor of one where everyone was bad. And only some people were worse than others, and those were really bad. And that's just, it is so, so wrong. If you go back and look at the correspondence of some of these people, I mean, they're writing at a higher level of intelligence and morality than you ever hear or rarely hear enunciated these days. Now, I'll give you an example. I mean, this is a famous tragic example from Lee's life. Lee, at the beginning of the war, is offered command of the Union armies. And though he says, look, I'm opposed to secession. I'm opposed to slavery. This is all on the record. I want no flag but the stars and stripes. I want no national anthem but Hail Columbia. But for all my love for the Union, I cannot turn my sword against my home, my family, my native state. Save in defense of Virginia, I will turn my sword on none. And a Union that can only be held together by swords and bayonets has no charm for me. And this is a man whose family had been in Virginia since the 17th century, who was married into George Washington's family, whose father served under George Washington. And you can see the human factor. And this is a man who is having to make a tragic decision, but is doing it in favor of flesh and blood loyalties, of being rooted in a place, even though he had served his country all over, you know, the continent. I'll give you maybe a higher-minded political example, which also ties to England, is that after the war, Lord Acton was corresponding with Robert E. Lee, and he said, I hope I get this right, he said, I mourn more for what was lost at Appomattox than I rejoiced for what was won at Waterloo. And the reason he said this was because Lord Acton is the man who gives us, he was Catholic too, like, he was the man who gave us the famous phrase, that power corrupts and absolute power.
That's right.
Corrupts absolutely. But he and Lee saw secession, or really had come to see secession, as a check on the arbitrary authority of the federal government. So if a state can secede, if it is truly a voluntary union, that means the federal government doesn't want to overstep too many bounds, because otherwise, oh, there goes Michigan, or oh, there goes Wisconsin, or there goes Alabama, or there goes California. We've got to keep everybody together here, so we're not going to do a whole heck of a lot. We're going to leave a lot more power to the states. And that would have been a great check on central authority, obviously. But, you know, for Lee, another thing for Lee about being an American, part of Americanism, was that you don't use force. And this may seem counterintuitive, because here's a guy, a military officer, gave orders, fought wars, but he believed that the mark of a gentleman, which of course he was the restraint in use of force. So the strong don't lord it over the weak, the intelligent don't lord it over the less intellectually gifted. And for him, for example, when it came to slavery, he said in a famous letter to his wife about 4 or 5 years before the war, this is an unmitigated evil. And he said it's a greater evil for the white man, because no one should have this much authority over anyone else. It's corrupting. But he believed that the way to get rid of slavery was through moral persuasion, especially Christian moral persuasion. And he believed in the absolute rights of a well-formed Christian conscience. But again, you lead by example. You try to respectfully persuade people. You don't use force. You don't kill them. You don't go to war with them. You don't chop them down because they disagree with you. And that's why in the Civil War, he said, I'm only going to fight in defense of my own area. In fact, when it comes to Virginia, a little bit of Civil War history here, the Lower South pulls out first. The states of the Upper South, including his Virginia, only pull out of the Union after Lincoln says, I want you, states, to raise troops to subdue the rebellion or the insurrection in the South. And that's when they say, nope, we're out. We're not going to fight our fellow Southern states. And for Lee, that was obviously the tipping point for him, both because he believed in duty to lawful authority, and he thought he was a Virginian, I have to follow my state, but also, I'm not going to use force to kill my own people to impose what they don't want on them.
It reminds me of that quote, I'm sure you know it, Harry, the one from G.K. Chesterton, which the true patriot doesn't hate what's in front of him when he's fighting, but he loves what's behind him. And that sounds like what Robert E. Lee was about. You also know that the first casualty of any war is truth. And whatever war we're in at the moment is probably a cultural war of some sort. And Robert Lee and his fellow travelers have taken the first bullet, I guess, in this conflict, in that they are being effectively, as we've just had from that text, written out of history. There is no good that can come from these people. But leaving that aside for a moment, because we're very quickly running out of time, unfortunately, give us a brief overview as to what he can speak to the modern world in terms of leadership. What can we learn about his style of leadership, his understanding of leadership, and how he inspired others?
Well, the book is obviously full of these sort of things, but I will say that in many ways you hear him sort of paraphrasing the Gospels. In one incident, a woman holds up her infant son to Robert E. Lee, and she says, what should I teach him? And you would imagine someone today would be telling him, teach him self-esteem, or teach him self-expression, or teach him that, good boys don't make history, or something like that. And what did Lee say? He said, teach him to deny himself. In a letter to his daughter, at one point, his daughter Mildred, he said, this conflict you feel between knowing that you should do one thing, but you feel like you should do another, that's common to everyone. But you have to always do your duty, and the more you do it, the more you do the right thing, the more you will have, it will get easier for you, but also you will have the great consolation of an approving conscience. So his big thing was do the duty, do the right thing, no matter how painful. Now, here's one other quick anecdote from after the war. A pastor was once talking to him about, if only we'd done this or that or the other thing during the war, South could have won. And Lee said along the lines of, yes, well, that's all very sad. But we can at least console ourselves that we did the best we could. We did our duty. And in God's good time, Providence will turn this right. And throughout the horrors of Reconstruction for him, I mean, he lost everything, his home, his money. He was deprived of his citizenship. He maintained his dignity. He became an educator at a small college called Washington College, now Washington Lee University. In the 4 years he was there, he took it from a school that had been reduced after the war, you know, impoverished, obviously, like the rest of the South, to four professors and 40 students. He turned it into a place that became a university just shortly after he died. And he expanded the curriculum to include all these, it was a classical curriculum, but he added engineering and business and journalism and law and medicine, all these things that he thought would be necessary to rebuild the South. So in many ways, if we are looking at a new dark age coming over us, which it's easy to imagine, he's sort of a voice of Christian stoicism, that no matter how dark things get, keep your eye on the prize, keep your eye on doing your duty, doing what is right, and trusting to Providence.
Mm. Do you find that given your sort of historical sweep, you know, you study many different periods, does it give you a certain ability to see the current political upsets, upheavals, or whatever, in their context, that these things pass, that there's such things as fads and fashions, even in historical cycles? I mean, are you hopeful about the future, not just for the United States, but maybe for the world in general?
Well, I'll give you a twofold answer. One is the reissue of this Lee book is part of there'll be two other books reissued in sequence. One will actually be Triumph, the Catholic history, updated, it too is about 20 years old or so, to include Benedict and Francis. That comes out in October, and then I have a history of the U.S. military called Don't Tread on Me, which will be reissued, updated in January. I will tell you, in doing the updates to both Triumph and Don't Tread on Me, I had two very different feelings after I finished them. I actually am quite optimistic about the church. The church has been through so much, and even though there's all sorts of horrible things happening now, I feel very confident that, you know, hell will not prevail against the church. However, doing the Don't Tread on Me book, the decline and fall of the United States seems so rapid. And the depth of the corruption that has allowed this to happen seems, it's harder to be optimistic. It's harder to be optimistic about my own country. That's why I am not at all, I have the idea that we are indeed potentially facing another dark age, both here and in England and across Europe.
Interesting. Of course, there's nothing new in this. I mean, I can remember, you could probably remember, was it 30 years ago, an English academic called Paul Kennedy was writing about the decline and fall of the United States.
Right.
And it's still there. So you never know. The one thing, I mean, I'm a keen student of history myself, Harry, and the one thing I know about history is that when you think it's going in a certain direction, it can surprise you, right?
Yes, and the one. I mean, I think I'm not the only one who hopes this. The problem is seeing how realistic it is. What America really needs is another great awakening. I mean, we really need a Christian revival in an enormous way, something that will come in with first principles and demolish all this cultural Marxism that has taken over all of our institutions. That's, if that were to happen, hallelujah, we'd be back in business. But the problem is, where is that coming from? And you look at some of these poll numbers about what people believe, and you think, jeepers, we are farther gone than I reckon.
Well, we live in hope. Listen, Harry, unfortunately, we've run out of time. Can you believe that? Can you tell people where they can pick up a copy of Triumph or Robert E. Lee on Leadership?
Yeah, all my books should be on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, all the normal the websites. Just type in H.W. Crocker, the third, or just H.J. Crocker, or whatever, and they should all come up.
And Harry, we're about to pray the Divine Mercy Chaplet live on air. Any intentions you'd like? We pray for all our guests, so you're included anyway. Anything in particular or anyone in particular you'd like us to pray for?
Sure. My sister has just been diagnosed with breast cancer. Her name is Lisa Brooke.
Lisa. Okay, we will pray for Lisa and we'll pray for you. Harry, it's been so good speaking to you. I hope you'll come back and talk to us again.
Great. Thank you so much.
Okay, that was H.W. Crocker III, who's a best-selling, award-winning author of many, many books. Check him out at Regnery Publishing. When we come back, we're praying the Divine Mercy Chaplet. Stay tuned to the Eternity Frequency, here live and exclusive on Archangel Video.